Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do, say don't cry because I'm alone.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jim Driever with us, the author of End Your Story, Begin Your Life, Wake Up, Let Go, Live Free. And he is an expert in the field of mind-body integration, stress management, and personal mastery. He's the author of many books, including The Way of Harmony, Walking the Inner Path to Balance, Happiness and Success, and The Ultimate Care, The Healing Energy Within You. Let's say, Jim, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for... Jim, when it comes down to it, just the title in and of itself, End Your Story, Begin Your Life. How many people are walking around and just completely, totally not alive? They're functioning all day long. They're in relationships. They have occupations. But if you really look at them, they're just walking around upright and dead.
Right. They're lost in this story. The story of suffering, the story of woe, the story of not having enough money. Whatever the story is, they kind of identify with it.
Now, by the way, the story in and of itself, is it a story that they've created because of themselves, or is it a story that they've bought because other people have defined their lives the way it should be?
It's probably both. But the fact is, we're a storytelling people, and our stories are important. But we're not our thoughts or stories, because the thoughts and stories come and go. But we, as pure consciousness, pure aware beings, are always here. And so what I teach people is, and I do this in my workshops and seminars, and of course in my book, is to see that they're not their story. They have a story, but they're not their story. So you're learning to be defined more by your awareness of being present here now, present and alive and awake in this moment now.
Yeah, it's interesting because most people, Jim, live, 2 years behind, an hour behind, 4 hours ahead because of what's going to go on, and they forget about this right now. I am quite confident that if most people try to get right now, real quick, without any kind of instructions of how to do it or step-by-step process, they'd have a very hard time just not thinking and just becoming part of what's going on at the moment.
Right, and that's why I developed the three-step practice, which is at the heart of my book, The Three-Step Practice of Freedom. So here it is. Whenever you're suffering, whenever you have conflict, upset, doubt, the step one is to learn to be present with it. In fact, you learn to eventually welcome it because it's showing you where you're not yet free.
Yeah, okay.
The second step is to notice the thought or story you're telling yourself, because there's always a thought or story behind suffering or conflict. It may be, this sucks, it's not fair, why has this happened to me, what's this all about, I'm lonely, I'm depressed. These are our stories that define us. And the third step is to see the truth. And the truth is, the thought or story comes and goes, just like the suffering or doubt comes and goes. But you, who you are behind your story, behind your thoughts, are always here. So breathe deeply and slowly and relax into being the beautiful, aware being you are right here, right now.
Now, by the way, the word presence is a very important word. Jim, can you define it in a way that most people can relate to? Because we've heard time and again, be in the now, be present. And there are a lot of people that say, yeah, sure, right. But, how do you do it? What does it mean if I don't have a symbol for it, if I don't have an image for it, if there's no anchor to hang on to say, this is what presence is, how do we know how to find it?
Okay, that's a good question, Michael. So presence is about being present here now, breathing, relaxing. I can guide your listeners through a little exercise, actually, in this moment right now. like just pay attention to the sounds around you right now. And just notice how they come and go. The bird sounds, the traffic sounds, studio sounds, whatever. Everything comes and goes, but you are always here. And then as you breathe more deeply and slowly and relax into your body, notice the body sensations and feelings in your body, how they too come and go. But you who notices them are always here. And then pay attention to the thoughts and images in your mind. Notice how they come and go constantly, even the I thought, the me thought. But you who notices them, these arising and coming and going thoughts, are always here. So breathe and relax and be here now. This is a direct experience of being present in the now, what it means to be present in the now.
You know, I really think that that's the difference between when you're talking about being present, being in the now. There's that old exercise that so many people aren't even aware of. If you really want to know what presence is, if you're sitting by a desk, touch the desk. The moment you touch the desk, you bring that desk into the present, into something that's alive, that's being at the moment. Because until you touched it and you put your concentration or your awareness on it, Gemma didn't even exist. And I wonder how many of us walk around and the world around does not exist because you're not even aware of it. I think there's a big difference between something experiential like touch the desk as opposed to assumption. Carl Jung said, we assume, and you know, you get an assumption. Well, if it's got an undefinable, if you can't put a proof on it, if it's something unprovable, then you take it on as fact and you live your life based on assumptions. And I wonder how many people, incontestable, that's the word I want. It has an incontestable conclusion. You can't prove it wrong. You take that assumption on as fact. You live your life and you do it in such a way that no matter what you do in life, it's really not the reality of life. And what you're saying is use the steps, get centered into what your life is as opposed to what you've assumed it to be.
Right. I'm really teaching people how to be, how to come from being their true nature. You know, we're called human beings. We're not called human doings. Yet most people are running around doing what they think they would need to do in order to be happy. And I teach it the other way around. Learn to be happy first. Learn to be content, alive, and relaxed in this present moment. And then from the space of being content and centered in the present moment, then you can think about what you need to do and then take action. And then you'll have the results you have. You'll have the fruits of your actions. But your happiness won't be dependent upon what you have anymore because it comes from being yourself, being true to yourself, being alive and aware in this very moment now.
Now, by the way, one of the things that you talk about is this word attachment. I wonder how many people don't even realize what they're attached to because they haven't sat down, they haven't got quiet. By the way, incontestable conclusion is what I was looking at before. You get a little older, okay. It kind of drifts away. But you move through life and you're not even aware of what you're attached to. Is some of the process that you use allowing people to recognize what their attachments are? Because if you don't know what it is, if you don't know the problem that you have, you can never work on it.
Right. That's an absolutely important part of my work, is to looking at what we're attached to, what we're identified with. And it comes down to what we're identified with really in our minds. Like if we're attached to a particular religious viewpoint, and then we meet something that says differently, we're thrown into the conflict. Or we're attached to a certain relationship, and we're thrown into the conflict. Very important to look at what we're attached to and realize that the attachments really only exist in our mind. And what exists in our mind is actually not real. Thoughts are not real. They may be true. I can tell you a story about what I did today, which is a true story. But the thoughts are not real in the sense that you can't actually find them anywhere. And that's a big part of the realization, actually. Because when you realize that thoughts are not real, and yet you as awareness, as awareness existing here now, as an aware conscious being existing here now, are very real. That results in a tremendous sense of liberation or freedom.
You know, by the way, this word fear is a very interesting thing. we get frightened of something, whatever that is, and we carry that fear with us. And 9 out of 10 times, I would venture to guess that nobody realizes where the fear came from and if the fear is real in and of itself. I'll give you a great example. 60-some-odd years ago, I was in Chicago. My mother chasing me down the hallway, and I hit this. I hit my bedroom, and the door was open. It was pitch black. I stood there, could not walk in. For almost all of my life, everywhere I went, if I was alone and I walk upstairs, I'd feel something behind me. 2 weeks ago, I'm walking up the stairs and I felt it again, but I stopped for a second and I realized it was nothing behind me. It was coming from the inside of the back of my head, which means it wasn't anything after me. It was something within me. And if it's within me, I can control it.
Yes. Beautiful, Michael. Beautiful.
Yeah, so, and that's really what it is. And most people are frightened to death of living their life. What if I could do this? What is somebody going to say about this, that, and whatever? So, Jim, let me ask you this. What do you do to take people through that ability to be unafraid, to unattach themselves from the fear that they created?
Well, in the book, I have a whole section on fear, releasing stories of fear. And that basically, it's all about getting free of fear and living a life of love, grace, harmony, ease, and flow. And all our fears are self-created. They live in our minds, the demons in our minds. So it's about facing our inner demons. You know, there's an old Irish saying, if you run away from a ghost, it'll chase you and haunt you for the rest of your life. If you stop and turn and face it, it'll disappear because ghosts aren't real. So I help people see the ghosts in their own mind, the ghosts of the past, the fears about the future, which are really conceptual fears, which produce very real feelings in the body. That's a very important feature in my book, too, is about understanding the connection between thoughts and stories in the mind and corresponding emotional reactions in the body. Because when you stop telling yourself any story and you're simply present, here, alive in the moment, feeling your body, feeling the ground beneath you, breathing the air, feeling the flow of your breath, everything is fine. There's no fear because you're not telling yourself any story. But as soon as you get into your mind, that triggers the fears and the guilt and the shame and everything else.
And let me tell you, the one thing that I really believe that, you know, end your story, begin your life. I think one of the reasons that is the window of opportunity for that book right now, where most people should get it in their hands, is because you look at all of the media messages that you're getting thrown at everybody. There is fear instilled. And the reason that they instill the fear is obviously to control and lead people down whatever path they want to lead them down. What most people really need is something to be able to filter those messages and understand that the fear that's created, there's a purpose for it to move you. If you begin to understand it, then the fear has no power over you.
Beautiful. Yeah, that's true. Very true.
Yeah. Now, by the way, let me ask you this. I pick the book up. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Jim, what's my takeaway? What do I, Michael, get that I did not have before I read this book?
You've got the realization, my God, I'm not my story. I have a story, but I'm not my story. I'm always this beautiful, aware being who's present right now. And that realization causes you to relax into the moment more and just to really take a deep breath, relax, and see what needs to be done now. See what needs to be, what actions is needed, if any. So it brings you back to a fresh, new perspective each time you realize the title of the book, End Your Story, Begin Your Life. It's constant renewal. You come back to this moment now with a clear eyes and a clear mind and an open heart, and you see everything anew.
Let me ask you this, all authors actually, when you put something to pen, obviously, whether it's fact, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, what happens when you do that, there's that time in the writing, and who knows when it happens, but there's this cathartic moment, there's this aha moment, when you begin to realize something of the subject matter that you weren't aware of before you started writing. Where was that for you in this? Where did you experience that something that you didn't know?
Well, in a a way, I experience it all the time because I'm always open to the new. I live by my own teaching. So there was no particular moment. This book came out of a realized perspective. But it took me 10 years to write it. It was the longest book I ever wrote in terms of years because I had three strokes in the middle of it. In 2004, I had these three strokes for a period of a few months, and that really knocked me on my ass and took me out of action for about 18 months. But as I recovered from the strokes, I realized that my strength was that I already knew myself as this pure awareness, this pure consciousness, and that really helped me. Deal with everything and flow with everything. So I flowed with the strokes, with the rehabilitation after it. I just was just present and within the flow with my healing and recovery.
Okay, well, Jim, let me ask you, what is a stroke? I don't mean physiologically what a stroke is and the chemical reactions and what the cause of it is, but what is a stroke when you really come down to it? It's probably the best thing that ever happened to you three times, but what is the stroke?
It's for me, it was a cosmic whack on the side of the head.
Yeah.
A cosmic whack on the head because it forced me to slow down. I was always a busy guy. Kind of an overachiever, and it really forced me to slow down, and that was the spiritual lesson of the stroke, I guess you could say. It forced me to slow down, and I couldn't do anything else, so it was a great teacher, patience. I finally learned the lesson of patience. I'm a double Sagittarian, and my nature is to be very impatient, so it's a beautiful lesson in patience.
I hear that loud and clear. Jim, we're just starting to run out of time. Website we can find you at, get the book, find out also what you're doing.
Okay, so you can go to my website, www.jimdreaver, that's JIMDREAVER.com. You can order the book on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com or your local bookstore, End Your Story, Begin Your Life. I'm doing some events in L.A. Anybody in L.A. who's listening, email me from the website, and I'll put you on my mailing list.
Hey, great. Jim Drever, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Michael. My pleasure.
Take care. Good night.
Good night now. Far away places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Places we're longing to see. Lisa Nichols with us, the author of No Matter What, 9 Steps to Living the Life that you'll love. She's a best-selling author, a popular public speaker, a powerful coach, and a charismatic teacher. She's reached millions both nationally and internationally with a powerful message of empowerment, service, excellence, and gratitude. Her participation in the self-development phenomena, The Secret, catapulted her popularity across the globe, and she's appeared on The Oprah Show, Extra, Larry King Live, and NBC's Emmy Award-winning Starting Over. Lisa High, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for welcoming me, Michael. I'm excited to be with you this evening.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when most people talk about living, you know, just breaking through and getting out of with that whatever it is, that shell that they're in, most people talk about it. They say, I want to do it, and if I can only do this, if I can only do that. Lisa, they just sit in their house, and they don't come out, and they don't do it anyway. So what do you do to stimulate them to get off the couch?
Well, first of all, recognize that the distance between you and everything you want is action. It's not about just thinking about it. It's not about just talking about it. You can't even, you know, journal about it and get there. It literally, the antidote for despair and the prescription for success is action. You know, there's the phrase that says the journey of 1,000 steps begins, 1,000 miles begins with one step. And it really is that. So the one thing I tell people is, what can you do tomorrow that you did not do today? Are you willing to say the things you don't want to say and do the things you don't want to do to become the man or the woman that you say you want to be? Everything is in the action step. So create an action plan. Whenever I coach people, we jump right into an action plan.
Now, by the way, one of the things that, you know, that this word action, one of the things that you say is probably the most potent word most people can get a hold of. You know, you think positive thinking. Well, all that's wonderful. But if you're in a hole and you positive think, you can be in the hole for the rest of your life. Appropriate thinking is putting action to the thought and moving yourself out of the hole, get a ladder and climb out. And I think that's really that step that most people don't want to take. They're frightened to death of it. Rather happy than unsure. Rather unhappy than unsure.
Absolutely. And I say to that, Michael, people will stay in an unfamiliar discomfort. They're more committed to a familiar discomfort than they are to an unfamiliar possibility. People are more committed to a familiar discomfort than they are to an unfamiliar possibility. So I say to that, are you willing to walk into the unknown? Are you willing to create the uncreated? Are you willing to see and do something and be someone that you haven't ever been before? Be willing to recreate who you've been. Most people are shackled to their past, shackled to 1996, shackled to 2007, and they say, well, this is the way I've always been. This is the way we've always done it. Well, he's always been that way. I've always been overweight. We've always struggled with finances. And my question to them is, so when are you ready to stop being that, since you've been it so long and you've done it already? Just because it's familiar doesn't mean it's comfortable.
So I think another way of looking at that is it's the not necessarily even recreating. It's the shedding that mask that we wear to protect ourselves.
Absolutely.
All of it's
absolutely
inside.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and all of it's inside. Every one of us has it inside. The problem is we're afraid to step outside, because if you step outside, something's going to get you.
Well, and you know, I always say, you know, when I wrote the book, No Matter What, you know, it was a pretty big deal in the publishing industry. I received a 7-figure book deal to do it. I was coming off The Secret. It's one of the largest books that a woman in the self-development industry has really gotten. It's on that. So it had a lot of energy behind it. And I remember one of the publishers saying, well, I'm not sure if we want to name it No Matter What. And I thought, wait a minute, I don't know if you know, but the fact that it's a 7-figure book deal doesn't make that title negotiable. See, No Matter What was what I used to transform my life. And No Matter What is when you, Michael, you've taken every other option off the table. When people set a goal, I want to make more money, I want this relationship to work, I want to lose 10 pounds. See, a lot of times when you set a goal, it's actually still negotiable, because you want it unless it costs you to do something that you don't want to do, which means it's still negotiable. My life, transforming my life from a struggling single mom, from someone on government assistance when my son was born, to a multi-million-dollar business owner, that was non-negotiable. I said No Matter What. So when the publishers wanted to challenge the title, I said, oh no, the title of this book will be No Matter What, because because that's been the statement, that's been the mindset, not just the statement, but the mindset that became the fuel to do the things that scared the bejeebies out of me. My knees were knocking, my teeth were chattering, it was unrecognizable, but I was willing to do that thing.
But you also have to be able to see it. And when I say see it, there's got to be, and everybody talks about this thing called a vision. But if you don't see it ahead of yourself, then you've got nothing to anchor to. There's no way that you'll recognize it if it actually happens. There's a woman that I know who grew up in poverty. She went into the service. She got her doctorate, and she got out of the service. She got married, and she and her ex-husband ended up on the streets, homeless, and the rest of it. And she moved her way out of that, and she went back to school, and she started teaching people about finance and so on and so forth. And one of the things that she said when she got into a group of people, the first thing she would say was, "How do you get financially stable?" And people start, "Well, I'll save this. I won't spend this. I won't do that." And the first thing out of her mouth was, "You got to see it. You got to have a vision." And I think that's realistically what it is. If you can show me what it can look like, now I know what to go for.
Absolutely, Michael. I used to stand in the bathroom long before I ever spoke to a living soul, and I would deliver what I believe to be a riveting, soulful speech in the mirror.
Yeah.
And now today, 15 years later, I've stood in front of 20,000 people, and I've seen you before. I've seen you in my bathroom. When I was in the mirror, I saw you. So, yeah, absolutely. Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind. You know, you have to know where you're landing before you ever take off. What's your GPS system? Where are you going? What's your intention? I remember when I was a little girl in South Central Los Angeles, I lived between the Harlem Crip 30s and the Roland 60s. I had three fights a week to get home from school. I was a C-plus student on my best day. And I remember coming home and I telling my mom and my dad, I'm going to live in an amazing home, in an amazing community. I'm going to fly all over the world. And my parents would look at me cross-eyed and they'd say, what are you talking about? I said, I don't know how, but I'm going to do it. And I'm going to have a house like the Brady Bunch. Because the Brady Bunch had two levels. They would walk upstairs and I didn't know what upstairs even looked like. I'd never been in a two-story home. And so you're absolutely right. And you can start with small 10 bite-sized, palatable, digestible milestones that lead to a bigger goal. But you have to stay in action. The difference between those of us producing magnificently in the world and those of us who are not is simply how we choose to spend each hour. How much action are we in? That's the only difference. I don't get more hours in my day. I don't get a hookup. I don't have a silver spoon in my mouth. I simply choose to be in crazy, unreasonable action.
Yeah, by the way, I was brought up about 25 miles from South Central. And when I was 21 years old, I went to work for Washington National Insurance Company, and they had me on a debit in South Central collecting 50 cents and 75 cents a week for health insurance. I know South Central.
Good. Well, quite familiar with it, yes.
Yeah. But it's true. It's what you want. Somebody once said to me, and I've repeated it before, but I think there's so much potency in it. If you want to know what your life is going to be like, you know, project yourself out 10, 15 years to a party. They're having a dinner party in your honor. And then you write down everything you want them to say about you. Now you got 10 or 15 years to become that. And that's the vision. I mean, it's there if you want.
I love it.
Let's go through understanding the muscles. Very important. Because life is like a muscle, isn't it?
Absolutely. And when I wrote the book, No Matter What, I made a point to develop these muscles, nine steps, nine muscles to live the life you love. Because on your way to bliss, Michael, and anyone that can hear my voice, you know exactly what I'm talking about. On your way to joy, on your way to peace of mind, on your way to financial prosperity, there are going to be speed bumps. There are going to be craters. There are going to be potholes. You're going to have some turbulence along the way. And to me, the muscles of your character, your understanding muscle, your forgiveness muscle, you know, your take action muscle, your say yes muscle, your faith in myself muscle, those muscles are the things that can get you back on course and keep you going and actually build your momentum. So when I wrote No Matter What, and when I do my trainings, any of my telecourses that I do, I always say, listen, let's build your muscles of your character so that you're not worried about what's around the corner, Michael. You tell whatever's around the corner all the what ifs that they had better worry about you because you're ready for it.
By the way, absolutely, and I think there's no question about that. What's the worst that can happen to you? Somebody's going to say no to you. And so what? You know what no means? No means not right now. There's something better. Go find it elsewhere. And I really believe in my heart of hearts, every time you get knocked down, every time you're on your rear end, when you get up, you've learned something, you become stronger, and it's going to take that much more to knock you down.
Well, you know, they say when a child is learning how to walk, when a toddler is learning how to walk, their legs aren't being strengthened while they're sitting down thinking of walking. And their legs aren't even necessarily being strengthened when they're actually in the act of walking. It's when a child is falling down and when they're doing that little wobbly thing called getting back up, it's in that wobbly get up, literally, that the muscles in their legs are being made stronger in that moment, the wobble and the getting back up.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think anything, I think life is like a muscle. It starts out with just, it's got a function to do, and you can either make it stronger or weaker. And if you work on it and you know the steps and you have that quote-unquote somebody holding your hand, another set of eyes taking a look at what you're doing, pointing out what you don't see, called the blind spot, you know, what it is you need to fix things, then all of a sudden that's where life is. Most people run through life alone. You could have 50,000 people around you day after day after day. But if you've got a problem, if you've got something lacking, something missing within you, and you don't know where to find it, you are very much alone.
Absolutely. And so, you know, when you ask the question, what do? I teach people all around, how do I do? How do I soar higher? I teach a lot of people who are playing their best game ever. I mean, they're living the life they love, and they love the life they live, and they just want to maintain that and take it to the next level. So the question is, what do I do? And then there's people who are trying to find the light again, and then people who are just hanging on for dear life, and they'd like to begin to thrive versus survive. So the question is, what do you do? When I wrote No Matter What, I made a point to put action steps in the back of every chapter because I know that reading is not enough, listening is not enough, but being in action. And so one of the things I would say is, how do you begin to do the things that you've never done before? Make a list of three things that you did not do this year as we round this year out. Three things you didn't do in 2011. Three things that you knew you wanted to do, but you didn't do them. And just make a point to do two of those things in 2012. When you are willing to do what you've never done before, you get to have what you've never gotten before, and you get to be who you've never been before. You will never become someone new doing the exact same thing you did in 2011. So what is that? And then the second thing I would say, Michael, is find people that you like the way they learn. You like the way they live. You like the way they exist, and learn from them. I have been a sponge. When my son was 8 months old, I didn't have money to buy him Pampers, Michael. I had to wrap my son in a towel for 2 days because I had no money. I look at that child. Now he'll be 17 the day after Christmas, and his life is barely recognizable. That same child, in one lifetime, he sat with the Queen of Swaziland. He's learned how to surf in Maui. He's traveled around the world. I mean, his life is breathtaking. The same child who I could not afford to buy Pampers. And I'm going to tell you, the distance between 8 months and 17 years was simply learning, being coached, listening to people, reading books and applying them. I'm that same woman who got kicked out of college my second year because I couldn't afford to go to college, and I never went back. So it wasn't about a silver spoon in my mouth. It wasn't about a bunch of letters behind my name. It wasn't even that. It was applying every piece of knowledge that came across my path that I found valuable, attaching myself onto people that I can learn from.
You know what I would say if somebody said to you, no, you can't, and then my response if I was you to them, get the Prozac out. You're going to need it. Okay, listen, we're just about out of time. Can we get the website you're at where we can get the books and find out what you're doing and follow?
Absolutely. If you go to, thank you so much for asking that. If you go to Lisa-Nichols, www.lisa-Nichols, N-I-C-H-O-L-S, give me your name and your email and let me send you this wonderful gift called Setting My Champion Free. And it was the thing that I chanted in the mirror every morning, started 12 years ago. And it really got me from a crawl to a walk, from a walk to a run, and from a run to a soar. And so I decided to kind of package that up and gift that to anyone who stopped by my website. So at the very least, do that so that I can love on you, I can adorn you, I can celebrate you for the amazing person that you are and the person that you are becoming. And if you so choose, you can go a little further and you can get the book No Matter What. It's under our products, so you can go over on Amazon. It's spicy, though, so if you decide to read the book No Matter What, keep a cold glass of water next to you because it does get spicy. I didn't sugarcoat the truth. I told on myself. I exposed some of my biggest breakdowns that I thought I'd take to my grave so that you can understand the power of a bounce back muscle. So thank you so much, Michael, for asking that.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much. And I've enjoyed every second of this. And good night.
I as well. Happy holidays. Good night to you. Bye-bye. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Pat Gehman with us, the author of The Power to Change, intensely passionate for living the full out and absolute clarity that people have been tapped inside of themselves, is what led Dr. Pat Gehman into coaching 15 years ago. Embracing Change describes her life. She was raised as a military child who was taught to make the best of circumstances no matter where she landed. Her vast experience includes raising 7 children, owning and running a highly successful multidiscipline healthcare facility. She was a professor at a chiropractic college while also being the administrator of a very busy outpatient clinic. And let us say, Pat, I welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the title in and of itself says a lot, The Power to Change. Change is not an easy word, is it?
No, it is not. Change brings chaos, whether it's good change or bad change. And now the chaos is what we learn to deal with.
Okay, but the word change in and of itself is frightening to most people. And it's not that a lot of people don't want to change. They don't know how to change. You know, there's that step-by-step, this is what you do if you want to change, but it's easy to stay there, and you can look out the door and hide and say, I'm not going out there, I'm safe right where I'm at.
That is so true, and one of the reasons I was pleased to be in this book that is co-authored is that there are many ideas for people. So if one thing doesn't appeal to you, there is another way. And I was just listening to Lisa Nichols' interview and her talking about take an action. Being in action is one of the keys. Of course, in order to change, you have to look at, did you choose the change? Did it come from internally or did it come from externally? So that's good. The first thing. We're in a state in our life right now where external changes are happening to people. you know, jobs are being changed, homes are being changed, economics are being changed. Those are all realities, and they're outside people. There's an internal change that has to happen as a result of that, and that is how they decide to be in action in spite of something they may not want. How do they create it into an attitude that continues to be of gratitude?
Now, a challenge that we have today, I think I mentioned this in the first interview of the evening, which is true. You've got all of this outside, this external influence that we have through the media. You've got all of these message units saying, if you do this, this is what's going to happen. We're going to take money away from you here. You're not going to get health care. We're going to be at war here. There's a terrorist there. I think that in and of itself is a very strong reason that most people don't want to change, because they're afraid of it. They've been pushed down, and they don't quite know what to do to take that step out.
I do agree with you. And again, I go back to the fact that when people realize that we always have a choice, at least we have a choice about how we respond to things. So we can let it put us down or keep us down, or we can make new choices. You know, it's also true that there are more people going into business for themselves, following dreams they've had forever, making them work. Lisa is a perfect example, coming from the poverty level and the single parenting, you know, difficulties that she had to where she is now today with the multi-million dollar business. Something inside of her changed. So it was, she found the agents for herself that enabled her to change, and part of it was action.
By the way, Pat, one of the reasons for bringing up all of those messages, that myriad of messages that we get, is that there is a way to move through and to change. The problem is most people don't know how. And that's where the key is. And what I'm saying is that there are options, there are choices that we can take, but you have to be aware of the choice and the options. Most people work on a problem that they don't have as opposed to the one that they do have, and they never get anywhere. It's called hone in on it. Here's the real problem. It's not coming at you externally. It's internally. You fix it internally, and everything outside looks different.
That is true, and that is, what, of course, what I do in my coaching business. It's also what the book is about. It's find a way to identify what it is you want to create in your life and then set about to change it. But even, Michael, even when that happens, there are two dominant emotions that accompany all change. One of them is fear. One of them is exhilaration.
Yeah.
The exhilaration is often followed by fear. So looking first of all, what are we truly afraid of? Playing the what's the worst case scenario game sometimes helps for people. It takes a little while to get through it. And once you do, you realize that all of us, if we're healthy at all, if we're here on the planet, if we have any kind of support system, if we have a roof over our head, we all have things to be grateful for. In addition to those external things, what about the skills and talents that we ourselves, every single human being here, leaves an imprint on the planet? Sometimes it's a matter of look at who you really are, not who you have sabotaged with your thinking for years and years, but that person that you really are with the magnificence that's within everybody.
By the way, Pat, there are two things, and then I'll say it a little different way than you said it. There are two things that motivate anybody. Mm-hmm. One is obviously fear of loss. The other motivation is the desire for gain. And if that desire for gain isn't fulfilled, it brings up the fear. And it boils down to this. It's the difference between a shot of adrenaline and a shot of dopamine. It's you're going to defense out against it, it's going to feel good. But it's a vicious circle unless you know how to get out of it.
Well, let me say that one of the things that I wrote about in my chapter is some of the latest findings in the last several years in neuroscience. And that is that we can retrain our brain. Now, why is that important? Because every single thought we have that has an emotion attached to it creates a cascade of chemicals into the brain that affect the way we think. So by being in touch with the emotion and choosing that the emotion of fear is often unreal. So it's the boogeyman in the closet kind of fear.
Sure.
We can retrain our thinking. Part of it is just stop it. Stop that thinking. Choose what you want instead. Put that new thought in its place. Neuroscience has shown we can change the hard wiring in our brain.
Sure.
So that's certainly one thing that we can do. Another one that I think is key is for people to be clear about what's valuable to you. Where are your values? We get confused sometimes. And, you know, we talked about those negative things. I never listen to the news or read the newspaper. I am not living in a, you know, bubble, so I do know there are some things going on out there that, you know, don't sound real good to me.
Sure.
But I don't let my mind dwell on them. And I think that makes a huge difference for people.
So now, by the way, when we're dealing with that, for me, Pat, the news is on constantly behind me based on what I do. I have to stay fairly abreast of what's going on.
Right.
But more important than that, I think it's the difference between intentional living and accidental living. Accidental living is not knowing how to bring yourself back out of it, how not knowing how to address the fear, and it's going out, whatever happens, happens. But intentional living is an entirely different thing. If I feel myself getting a little upset, I think of a puppy dog. And when I think of a puppy dog, it makes me soft inside, and all of a sudden I change that chemistry, and now I'm being intentional, and I'm controlling the outcome of what goes on in my life and what comes at me.
And Michael, that goes back to the book, The Power to Change, and 19 different chapters on ways that we can find that exact place within us to create the supportive thinking, the supportive action, to move us closer to what we really want in life, to keep us from muddling around in what we don't want. And so that becomes the method of intentional living indeed. And I think it is when people understand that and they claim it for themselves. They may not know all the ways to do it, but there's 19 different ways lined out in this book that I think are a darn good start. You know, there are things that people can, again, choose, recognize we have choice. Every single person has choice. And that's the intentional living idea.
So sure. And we control we actually control what's going on around us. And when I say like we control that, if you walk up to me in public and you slap me in the face, I cannot control that. You've done it. But I also have choice in the way that I respond to it and the way that I feel about it. That's where, Pat, that's where the real power is, and most people don't get that. It's how you respond is where your strength is.
Well, and that's that, again, that's that internal choices that we can make about what's going on and the attitude that we can develop around it really determines the quality of our life.
Oh, sure. So, by the way, no question about it. And I really believe that it's okay to take charge. Most people, Pat, need permission to feel okay. And there's only one person who can give you permission, and that's that person that's looking back at you from the mirror. We make the mistake of thinking we need the approval or the permission of someone else to do, to be something, to feel a certain way. And as long as you're doing that, you're not who you are. You're who someone else thinks you should be. And your life is based on not upsetting someone. So you hide and there's no action.
And Michael, that's so true. And there's a whole group of us that are able to do that on our own, more or less. You know, we may read some books, talk to some people, attend some seminars. There are those who do need some external encouragement.
Yes.
And so that's where some of the books that you bring on to the show, you know, the coaching that people do, that's where that becomes so very important. You know, I tell my clients, let's look at your whole life. They'll come to me with one problem. Well, the one problem is probably a reflection of a lot that's going on in their life. So we start with looking at their whole life from a balanced perspective, so that I can get an idea of how they deal with, you know, the challenges and the day-to-day living issues. Then we can look at, all right, you're considering this, but problem that you want me to give you permission to get out of, but I want you to own part of it. So for people to get the skills, to learn the methods, that's where it becomes important for them to recognize change is chaotic, as I said in the very beginning.
Sure.
And the chaos is okay. It can be good. Out of that can come really fine things. You know, it's that old thing of, are you going to, you know, you're handed lemons, you might as well make lemonade.
Oh, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that I've learned from years ago, 150 years ago, I used to do workshops and things, but that was another life in a whole different place. But I remember one of the exercises I used with people, I would have a couple of people get together and they'd sit and there'd be maybe 30, 40, 50 people in a room, if not more, and you'd have people paired up. And what they would say is, one of the things I don't like about myself is, and when you tied it all the way down to, you know, you peeled it all away, it was coming out to, you know, I'm not worth it, I don't deserve it, nobody likes me, and yada, yada. And when they finally got down to that, I remember I used to say, okay, now you know who you are. Go introduce yourself to everybody. And you have people walking around the room shaking hands with somebody. I'm no good. Well, I'm not worth it, and I don't deserve it. And you get this going, and then pretty soon you'd hear tears flowing. And then it kept going, and all of a sudden somebody would break out in laughter. And then the entire room would go into hysterics when they realized what was driving their life all of these years. Because underneath it, that's what was driving who they were, who they would be around, and who and what they would bring into their lives to validate that they don't deserve it.
One of the things that happened to me, again, many, many years ago when I was on my own personal growth path, not that I'm not still, but when I was first introduced to it, was I realized that my lack of self-worth came from remarks that my father, whom I believe meant well, I believe he was doing the best job he knew how to do.
Sure.
But I didn't believe it at that time, and comments that he would make. And one morning I was sitting there meditating, and all of a sudden it was like, how long are you going to let your father run your life? At the present time, he was out of the country, you know, not there, not being the Navy commander in my life. And I went, he's not running my life. Oh, yes, but he is. So I often ask people, who's running your life now? It doesn't matter where that programming or who gave it to you. I don't care how dysfunctional and abusive and all of that. Today, right now, today, ask yourself the question, who's running my life? How do I want it to be? I'm in charge after all. I can make the changes that will support me instead of continuing to sabotage myself.
Sure. And those thoughts about who's running your life, you have to even take it a step beyond that. That person could have passed away 25, 35 years ago, and they're, quote unquote, still running your life. And, and it's time. And they're not running it. You're running it through them. But you got to get that. And I think that's one of the hardest things for people to do, just to say, okay, you know, who's responsible for all this? Can't be me, but it is us.
Of course you're responsible. It's you allowing that thinking. You know, when we're little, we're taught, don't go in the street. It's very dangerous. And I can remember being so angry at my two very little kids because they went in the street one day. I mean, they got in major trouble.
Good.
Well, you know, they're adults now. I hope they know how to cross the street, that they're not still playing the don't go in the street. Now, truth is, streets are dangerous, but you learn street crossing behavior. You
sure
can do the same thing with other aspects of your life. Learn new behaviors. Get over the sabotaging and limiting beliefs that may be carried over from something that was said to you, again, in well-meaning. Now, not to say that there aren't, you know, there aren't some bad parents out there or bad parenting skills, but, you know, often our parents did the best they could. Or
yeah,
the
no
other adults
about
in our life do the best they can.
And it comes this way also, Pat. It comes this way. I remember years ago, my dad passed away when I was, 8 years old. And I remember it was very interesting. I was talking to someone about it one day. And he said, well, he rejected you. I said, what do you mean he rejected me? The guy died. He said, no, no, the opposite of acceptance is rejection, which really made me take a look at something. We could be run by someone else's thoughts, and they're not even here, and it's what we defined out of the actions or the experiences or the occurrence at the time.
Exactly. Exactly. So, again, learning how to make change, to choose change in your life, I think is a really important skill. I'm so proud to be part of this movement that empowers people and uplifts them and lets them begin to see how much more they are than they allow themselves to believe, and to give people skills to be able to do that. You know, if this way doesn't work, let's explore that way. If that way doesn't work, let's explore another way. You know, we can tell people meditate. We can tell them to journal. We can tell them to breathe deeply. We can tell them to, you know, have regular exercise programs. We can give them all kinds of things, make vision boards. All of those are workable. They're very workable. And for some people, they will be the exact thing they need. For others, it's like, okay, now I have one more thing I should be doing. And quite honestly, I do not believe that we should on people. I do not believe we should let anybody should on us.
No.
And
no.
And so, no, don't give them something that just doesn't work for them. Find another way.
Pat, we're starting to run out of time. And by the way, I think you're spot on with everything that you're saying. Now, can we get your website and how to find you, the books, and follow you?
Yes, please. My website is www.capacitycoach.com, and you can follow me on all those Facebook things at Capacity Coach, and Twitter, it's ChiroMom1, and the LinkedIn, you'll find me if you look for me. I also, Michael, may I give my email address? I don't mind doing that.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
It's Dr. Pat, D-R-P-A-T, at capacitycoach.com.
Hey, and Pat, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye.
You feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging. You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me, you're wrong. Yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. Yeah, I'm gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so free. You're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. My hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you're.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
If you need me, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're missing your brown eyed daddy. Grab it now, some of these days.
Dr. Mitchell Bard with us. Mitchell Bard, PhD, is one of the leading authorities on U.S. Middle East policy. He's the author of The Arab Lobby, The Invisible Alliance That Undermines America's Interest in the Middle East. He's the executive director of the American Israeli Cooperative Enterprise, director of the Jewish Virtual Library, the world's most comprehensive online encyclopedia of Jewish history and culture. He's written or edited 22 books, including 48 hours of, I'm not even going to try to say it, Mitchell.
Chris Baldwin.
Mitchell, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you again, Michael.
Oh, and thank you so much for coming back. I won't even try. Now, let me ask you this. When we talk about an Arab lobby, there is something that undermines a lot of the activities that could go on as far as a relationship between us and the Middle East. But that's not only there. I think inherently it's within our country in and of itself. If we trace it, and I mean, you've got to go back to the old, how do you solve a problem? You follow the money. If you follow the money, usually you can uncover the problem.
Well, that's right. Basically, this problem with the Arab lobby goes back about 80 years to the discovery of oil. And we've made a Faustian bargain with the Saudis where we agreed that we would keep their royal heads on their royal shoulders in exchange for them selling us oil. But they don't do us any favors because they treat us like drug addicts, and they manipulate the price of oil in such a way that they continue to make big profits but discourage us from investing in alternative sources of energy.
No, absolutely, and there was a tremendous amount of money that they have made for us. I think originally, weren't we there in security for I lost the word I wanted, but the Arab, I lost my word, so help me out here, Mitchell. But yeah, the people who run the country, as a matter of fact, we were the security for them. There was private security that came in from us. Also, we were selling them weapons, so we were making money with them for many, many years.
Well, basically, it's an exchange where they sell us oil and we sell them weapons to get some of the money back, but they're basically arms that they don't need and they can't use. And what they've done is basically try to undermine not only our interests in the Middle East, but they also undermine our values by being one of the most oppressive countries in the world. And they more significantly and more dangerously threaten our security by being the principal sponsors of terrorism around the world.
Now, by the way, why aren't we seeing this? And when I say why aren't we seeing this, it's there, it's obvious, the world knows about it, but yet we seem to want to turn our back on it.
Well, a lot of it isn't so obvious, unfortunately. That's why I had the subtitle of The Invisible Alliance, not because there's a conspiracy, but because much of what the Saudi and Arab lobby do is happening behind the scenes, where you don't know that the Saudi ambassador has a basically open door to the White House or was playing racquetball and tennis with the Secretary of State or the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and that basically they've been buying influence by investing in the last 10 years since 9/11 about $100 million in public relations and K Street lobbyists to try to promote their view of the world.
You know, it's interesting because administrations come and go, but it seems as though something of this nature seems to be an underlying force that just doesn't seem to want to go away. And it's not just this administration or the administration before it, but this has been continuous and it doesn't want to stop.
It's absolutely bipartisan. And basically one of the things the Saudis have said is that if you treat your friends well after they leave office, you'd be surprised how good of friends you have when they're in office. And so State Department officials and other government officials know that if they are good to the Saudis, that they will get good jobs, good consulting contracts, other kinds of deals when they get out. One of my favorite stories was about this obscure southern governor who wanted to get money for a Center for Middle East Studies for his state university. And the Saudis probably looked at them and said, we don't even know where this state is. Well, that obscure southern governor later became the Democratic candidate for president, and suddenly the university got $3.5 million for its Middle East Studies program. And then when that obscure governor, who was Bill Clinton, became president, the University of Arkansas suddenly got $20 million. And this is the way they have operated, by basically using their money, using the supply of oil to try to manipulate our policies. They're doing it right now with President Obama. You may have noticed that President Obama has been very outspoken about the changes in the Middle East and calling for freedom and democracy every place except Saudi Arabia. And that's in part because the Saudis are keeping the price of oil relatively low to prevent our economy from getting any worse and helping Obama to be reelected. And so the unspoken bargain is that we do that for you. You keep quiet about democracy for us.
And by the way, again, it has been constant and it keeps going. Is there, the question is simple, but Mitchell, the answer is not simple. Is there a fix to this? How do you fix it?
Well, it's certainly not easy. We need to develop an alternative energy policy so we are less reliant on Saudi oil. We need to basically stand up to them and say that their policies are unacceptable, that we will not stand by while they treat women in an apartheid fashion, that we won't let them discriminate against Jews and Christians, that their human rights policies are unacceptable, that we won't allow them to continue to put textbooks out into schools, not only abroad but here in the United States, that teach that Jews and Christians are apes and pigs and that a jihad should be launched against the infidels. We need to simply stand up for our principles. And unfortunately, the only president who's ever been willing to do it was John Kennedy, who back in the 60s told the Saudis they had to abolish slavery, which they were still legally practicing 100 years after the Civil War.
And look what happened to him. You know, and who knows still who was the one behind what happened to him. I think the big problem is that we're going through not only the same thing today, but we're frightened to death of saying anything to anybody to upset them. You know, we can get into the word political correctness, but it's gone way beyond that today. It's gone to a point where the president of the United States does not want to say anything to anybody in Iran because they don't want to upset them because they might get mad at us and they might go to war. We're pulling troops out of a place we shouldn't be pulling troops out of right now. I don't mean to be in combat, but to at least have a presence there. We're pulling people off the border. So I don't quite know what's going on right now, because if there's something that's underneath what it looks like, we better be aware of it. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not. I never have been. I'm a pragmatist. You take a look and you see what's going on and you say, if you add all these pieces to the mix and they add up to this, where is it going to lead us? And I really believe that your book, The Arab Lobby, is just scratching the surface to what's going on in this world today. The book is the model, and we're not following, and we're not seeing what that model is and what it's doing to the world.
Well, I think reading the book will help expose people to a lot of things that you're talking about that they probably are unaware of, because so much of what the Arab lobby does is not transparent, that it's threatening our interests in multiple ways. You know, the person in charge of terrorism and financial intelligence at the State Department, at the Treasury Department, said that if he could do one thing and snap his fingers, he'd cut off funding from Saudi Arabia for terrorism, because they're the real epicenter that's undermining our security. And they're investing tens of millions of dollars in American universities and increasingly filtering down into the K-12 system in a way that is very dangerous for us.
No, absolutely. Take a look. By the way, I was trying to think of royal family before I knew that they were called something. But when it really comes down to it, take a look at what goes on. I one of the things that we're being attacked with right now, along with what you're saying, is happens to be the culture. Now, I was brought up singing Christmas carols. I was brought up with Christmas trees and presents and whatever. Now, I happen to be Jewish, but that was the culture that went on, and that's what we did. Now, the point is, I don't like the idea of all of this stuff stopping and it being thrown out of the schools and so on and so forth, because, Mitchell, what's going on, there's an attack on the culture. That's where the key is. You know, if you're an American, you can't do anything anymore. But if you're anything else, but you have free reign. And there's the problem. Who we are is getting diluted. And if we get diluted enough, we will not be able to do what you've got outlined here in the book.
Well, that's one of the ironies, is that we don't even stand up for these principles for our own troops and our personnel in Saudi Arabia when we sent 500,000 men and women to risk their lives to keep the Saudis' heads on their shoulders. Our soldiers were told they shouldn't celebrate Christmas, they should hide their crosses and Stars of David. And before that, our State Department was appeasing the Saudis and telling the U.S. government they shouldn't send Jews to come to Saudi Arabia. And this kind of caving into an oppressive culture and saying it's okay for them is, I think, part of the weakness that you're talking about. No, we didn't do this with South Africa. We never said, you know, just because it's their culture, we're going to stand by while they oppress the black majority there. But we do stand by while the Saudis oppress women in their country and while they discriminate against others.
No, absolutely. And I think when it comes down to it, we are toe-to-toe the most ferocious fighting force in the entire world. Nobody stands up to us, and I don't care who they are right now. So if you want to beat the United States, if you want to beat America, the way you do it is you do it internally. You make us implode. You divide us. You divide us, you conquer us. You dilute the very strengths that we have. And if we step back and look, Mitchell, that's what's going on today. We're being divided. You got the class warfare, you got the this, the that, the whatever, this one doesn't like that. If you're Christian, you get everything thrown out. If you're Jew, you can't go over here. But if you're anything else, you don't dare talk about it. If you want to, with all due respect, if your culture says a woman wears a burqa, you don't wear it. You don't wear the top when you're getting a driver's license, so you can't see somebody's face because that's identification. But they get to do that. So you have to sit back and say, what's going on here? And if it doesn't stop, who we are is not going to exist in the very near future.
Well, there's certainly a degree of intimidation that goes on where when you try to point out the problems of Islamic extremism, then you're labeled Islamophobic. But the reality is that while most Muslims, for example, are peace-loving and they practice Islam in a way that's not threatening, there are those who have a very different view, and in particular, those are funded and supported by the Saudis. Just to give you one example, there's a school that had a map of the Middle East on the wall that was missing just one country. You might guess that country was Israel, and in their 11th grade textbook, it said, on the day of judgment, the trees will say, O Muslim, O servant of God, here is a Jew hiding behind me. Come here and kill him. And their 12th grade Islamic studies textbook quoted a verse that said, the apes are the people of the Sabbath, the Jews, the swine are the unbelievers of Jesus' table, the Christians. And this isn't a school in Pakistan or Afghanistan or even Saudi Arabia. These were textbooks in a school funded by the Saudis in Fairfax, Virginia.
Yeah. No, I got it loud and clear. And this is constant. But nobody dares say anything about it, because if you do, again, you're a racist, you're a bigot, you're a something. And it's a very powerful weapon today. We've gotten to a point whereby we're allowing our history to change through the school system. And these kids today have been, they've been socially engineered, and I really don't like saying that, but they've been taught to think and feel a certain way. And it's really not going to do a lot of people any good. You fight with our military, and you talk about how bad they are. It's those kids that are going out that are losing legs and getting killed that allow you and I to talk this way on the radio, allow women to walk down the street, to vote, to drive cars. My goodness, all the things that we stand for, it seems as though there is a segment of this population in our own country that is fighting against it, and it's very scary.
Well, it is, and we have to stand up for our principles and set examples. In the Middle East, when we support the democratic ally Israel, that sends one message. But when we're supporting autocratic theocracies like the Saudis, that sends a very different message. And when we call for freedom and democracy in new Arab governments, but at the same time look the other way while the Muslim extremists attempt to take power through the voting process and be silent, we're going to end up with a Middle East that's very unstable and very dangerous for all of us.
No question about it. And we've gotten so sensitive today. I remember, we won't tell anybody the dates here. We'll keep this between you and I. But 1960, the latter part of 1960, I was in the Marine Corps in those days. And we were out and we were training. And I remember it was a Sunday afternoon. And I was standing up on the hill with a couple of the guys. There was a large group of people. There were, you know, there was the Sunday services for the Catholics, the Protestants, etc. Now there was me, two atheists, and a Buddhist standing up on the hill. They're not going to bring a rabbi in for one person, and there's no problem with that. And in those days, it was like, okay, so big deal. I'm up here, I'm doing my stuff, and I'm fine. Today, nobody would dare do anything like that because the lawsuits and everything else would start. We've gotten to a point now, we have become so sensitive that if you dare do anything to be able to help someone, to be able to help not only our economy, but the culture that we live in, the things that we fought for, the things those kids died for, it's all going down the tubes. And somebody better stand up and do something about it because, again, I know I said this early on, we're in trouble.
Well, we also have a built-in bureaucracy that perpetuates many of the problems, in particular the Erebus and the State Department, who, going back to the 1930s, who were treating American Jews the same way that they treated European Jews and ended up with many Americans finding themselves either in internment camps or concentration camps. I wrote a book called Forgotten Victims, The Abandonment of Americans in Hitler's Camps, that tells that story. And the same kind of attitude in the State Department pervades today. You can go back, you were talking about the 1960s, for example, and there was a report by the State Department in the late 60s talking about how we needed to find alternative sources of energy because the Arab oil producers could create serious security problems for us, and they said we should invest in solar and nuclear and wind and all the things we talk about today, but they said that none of those things are feasible, so instead what we really need to do is just divorce ourselves from our relations with Israel. And that's the kind of mentality that rather than solve the problems in the way they need to be solved, they try to blame Israel often, or to in some way appease the Arab oil producers. And that's not getting us where we need to be as a free society that is secure and representing the values of our Constitution.
And lest we forget, somebody was making some money somewhere. And it just we're starting to run out of time, but take a look at what's going on recently with the dollars that have been spent on, you know, green energy and so on and so forth, and the bankrupt companies, and how the money was spent and what they've done with those dollars. So, you know, there's no control over any of this. And I really believe that if you take a look at what's going on, our economy is eroding. And I would venture to guess that it's purposeful. And then there'll be another economy underneath it to take over. And it won't be who we think we are. That said, let me ask you this, Mitchell. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Sure. You can find information at jewishvirtuallibrary.org or mitchellbard.com.
Okay, and wonderful. And by the way, we can get the books there?
The book is available in your local bookstores, on Amazon. Should be able to get it through our website on the Jewish Virtual Library as well.
Wonderful. And by the way, don't be a stranger. Please come back on the show soon.
Happy to do it anytime. Thanks.
Take care. Good night.
Good night. And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Oh, that's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. They would give you the world for a toy.
All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. The book is A Princess and Her Garden by Patricia Adson, PhD, Dr. Adson. And her entire professional career, she's been devoted to helping others discover their best selves. A former school teacher, she's taught many high school, she's taught high school English, social studies. While pursuing her master's degree in education, she began working with children with emotional and behavioral disorders. And it was this experience that inspired her, when she was 49 years old, to enter a PhD program in educational psychology, where she's also received training and license as a psychologist, a psychotherapist, working with individuals, families, and groups. Patricia, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. A Princess in Her Garden, Becoming the Queen of Yourself. Is that a very hard thing for women today to do?
Yes, it is. And it's sort of a natural thing. You know, we tend to, I mean, this has to do with men as well, but primarily this book is written for women. And we try to take care of everybody else and forget how to take care of ourselves. And I talk about this, I wrote this story, it's a little fable, and so that we can have a language with which to speak about this that isn't a language of pathology or something wrong with us or, problems to be solved, but just a way of looking at the responsibility we have to care for ourselves and to care for others at the same time. It's not one thing or the other.
Sure. Now, by the way, there was a culture of women in the 40s, in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. There was a tremendous amount of transitions. I think in the 50s, more than anything else, women started staying home to raise families because they lost so much of their families during the Second World War. In the 40s, women went to work. You know the story. And the equality came. Then the changes started to happen. And when the changes happened, it got confusing for a lot of people. I just opened up the book. I have it in front of me to page 25. And the very interesting, because it says it all right here. The wizard didn't give me what I sought. Could I have failed again? Very interesting. When you think you should be getting a certain thing and you don't have it, there's that inner feeling of failure, which causes a life to be put in a closet someplace and not go out and live the life they could have had.
Right. So we start to concentrate on the other person. What did they want from me that I wasn't able to give them? So that we think in some way we have failed or there's some deficiency that we have.
Yeah, and by the way, most people are brought up thinking that they're deficient in some way. I really believe if you walked into a market and you got 90% of the people in the market, if you said, are you deficient, which you wouldn't do, but I would bet you would get, if there was an answer from the little voice inside, I bet you would get a yes.
I think so, yes. That we don't understand, and that's the story of this garden, this fable is that on her birth, the princess was given a garden that contained everything that she would ever need. But she could not, at that young age, take care of it. And so that is the story of human development. We have this enormous potential, and we have a huge reservoir of energy and resources within us. But as children, we need to have other people take care of us. And so what we learn to do is how to keep them taking care of us. Okay, I'll take care of you, so you'll take care of me. And we think that's the way life is.
The matter with taking care of yourself? My mom was, she was 5 foot tall, but she was tough. And then she raised, three boys and a girl. My dad passed away when I was at a very young age. I was 8 years old, and she took on all of it. And
right.
She was a waitress, and that's how she made her money. And she bought this little house for $50,000. I think, what was it? It was oh, how much was it a month? I think it couldn't have been more than about $25, $30 a month, whatever it was, you know, the monthly mortgage. And what she taught us was, you're going to get smacked, so get smacked, get up, and keep going. But that's not everybody's background.
Right, and your mom, you know, that's a wonderful story. And think of all the resources your mom had, you know, within herself,
sure,
in order to do that, you know. And not so many people really have the awareness that they're capable of doing those things. And,
but at the same time, she was a prime example of what you're talking about here, because she quit school in the sixth grade. And I remember that the local arm of the one of the political parties wanted her to be a chairman, and she was afraid to do it because she couldn't read really well in public. So it has its effects. You know, you got the good side and you got that side that you're talking about. And in those days, you know, you're talking about the early to middle 50s to late 50s. And in those days, we had a completely different mindset. There weren't people like yourself saying, you can do this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm very familiar. I'm very familiar with. I was alive then, you know. I'm 82 years old. And I was married in 1951. And I had five children. And I thought that my whole life was going to be, you know, just to be a wife and a mother and live happily ever after. And so it took me a lot of interesting and difficult situations in my life to realize, wait a minute, I had the responsibility to take care of myself, you know, to really have to do that as well as taking care of my children. And to understand that emotionally, as well as physically and economically, that my happiness was my problem, not somebody else's. People weren't there to make me happy.
Absolutely. By the way, in 1951, I was 9 years old. So it was that part of growing up. But, you know, the one thing about growing up in the 50s, what a gift. We were so innocent. Yeah,
right.
It was just that'll never come again. And there was a few of us who got to see it. And it was a completely different world. But that's not the world that we have today. The world that we have today, for the most part, is that you fall down, and all of a sudden, Patricia, you have to have the counselor there to make sure that you're not emotionally upset. You fall down or you say something, and somebody's accusing you of something. So we live in a very interesting world today where on one side we say, stand up, be responsible. But on the other side, they say, well, if you do, you can go to jail for it. So there's a lot of mixed messages going on today.
Yes, and I think that's one of the messages of this book. The book is combined with a journal. And so you can take the lessons of this story and then begin to write your own story of your life and how you, how you learned what you did, but how you can, that now that you are grown up, you can do very different things. Essentially, you can become your own parent. And so you can encourage yourself. If you fall down, you stand up. You don't need to have somebody else encourage you to do that as an adult.
Yeah.
You take responsibility for yourself.
And by the way, in today's world, you know, through story and journal, self-care guides help overextended women to set boundaries. There's a tremendous amount of overextended women today. There is there's so many demands.
Yes, and that's another big message of this book, is really the idea that you have a garden of your own, and you're in charge of it, and you're in charge of building a wall around it and maintaining that boundary and keeping the gate, opening the gate or closing it yourself. So you learn how to say no. And in essence, you learn how to say yes to yourself as well.
Sure.
So it's not just saying no to someone else.
Yeah. No is a very powerful word. And if you understand the strength of the word, the definition of the word, I don't mean the dictionary definition, but the emotional definition, it's a very powerful word, because no is a very powerful yes to many things for you.
Yes.
Yeah. No to them, yes to me.
Yes. And what so many of us, and I can speak certainly for women, here is that we're so afraid that somebody won't like us if we say no.
Yeah.
Or somebody will be disappointed in us. We're so afraid of the reaction of the other person that we give up ourselves.
No question about it. We live our life. You know, I may touch on this probably 100 times a week, if not 200 times a week. But the problem is we live our life based on someone else's definition of how we should be. And we're not them. At my optimum, Patricia, I can only be the second best you. No matter what I do, I can never be the first best Patricia. So I will always have a delusion if I'm trying to do that. I will never have, quote unquote, perfection, because I'm always going to be the second best. And if I live my life that way, then I'll be the second best no matter what I do. I got to come out and be the first best me.
Yes. And so these metaphors from this fable about the garden and your garden and how you take care of it will help you to do that, will help you to understand as people work through this journal what that means. You know, who are they really? What are they passionate about? What are, to really get that instead of what everyone told them they should be.
Well, I think that's really what it is, what everybody told them what they should be. And what you should be is who you are if you will allow yourself. Not everybody else. Nobody can allow you to be who you are. You got to be who you are by yourself. You got to take up that particular strength. You do that, and all of a sudden, the world completely turns around for you.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And we really are quite powerful.
Yeah. And when you stop thinking about what they think, who cares what they think? They're going to think it anyway, so there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, I think one of the things, though, that is really helpful is to understand we are always going to care what other people think. We just have to be conscious of that and then say, yes, I care what they think, but I have made a decision to do this anyhow.
Okay, by the way, let's take it a step farther. Well, you know, I've asked people over the years, when you got up in the morning, who did you get dressed for? And they'll say, I got dressed for me. Well, no, you didn't. You got dressed for someone else. If there was nobody around, you were on a deserted island. If you were a man, you probably wouldn't shave all day long. And if you wore clothes, so what? Who cares? You can't go out into public like that. You can't go out on a date like that. You can't go to anything social like that. You can't do a presentation like that. So we do things for others, and that's okay. That's got to do with a completely different dimension of a life. But when it comes to yourself, your personal self, that's when you do for you. But yeah, we do for other people, sure.
Certainly. I mean, we have to be socialized. We come from a culture, a tribe, a family, a neighborhood, whatever, and we learn, you know, what's expected in order to get along with other people and function in the world.
No question about it. Now, Patricia, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you, where we can find the book?
Yes. The website is www.aprincessandhergarden, all one word, .com.
Okay. And by the way, the book is there. We can get the book.
You can get the book there, and you can also get it on Amazon.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thanks for having me.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. Second,
They would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Wakefield with us. He is the author of Easy Fit. He spent decades as a fitness advocate and a health club entrepreneur, training with some of the biggest names in the fitness industry. And the book again is Easy Fit, a simple guide on how to look and feel great. David, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about being healthy and being fit, there's so many people who think that it's a struggle. You got to get up in the morning, you got to work out for 2 hours. Sometimes during the day, you got to go out and run, and then at night, you got to work out. Doesn't quite work that way, does it?
No, not at all, really. You know, it's even 20 minutes a day will keep the doctor away for you, really seriously. What we're doing with our book is providing an easy way to help inactive people look and feel better with a little bit of exercise. And, you know, the problem is 65% of the people are inactive and are overweight. 35% are obese, causing them to be at risk for, you know, high blood pressure, coronary heart disease, and some cancers. So it's really important that we all get moving each day, and it doesn't have to be a lot. You can ask yourself the question, fit for what? You know, you're going to be in the Olympics, so you just want to look and feel a little better, right?
Absolutely.
You know, like... people that are really overweight spend another 42% on healthcare annually, more than a normal weight person. And we spend $75 billion annually in the United States due to people being overweight. So it's an epidemic, actually. So we're trying to help them out with this little bit of information in our book.
Now, by the way, I've got the book in my hands, and I've been a bodybuilder for, what, 50 years now. So I don't know what it's like not to go to the gym. But what I'm looking at in here... with the resistance training, the workouts, with all it is, you got a chair. And what you can do with that, and I think it's phenomenal. You don't have to go to the gym, and you don't have to spend a ton of money on equipment to bring home.
Yeah, that's the whole idea here is that, you know, you can do your program anytime, anywhere. I always recommend a morning thing if people have room in their morning to get it over with because we get distracted throughout the day. And the other thing I recommend is you make an appointment on the calendar for the time and the day that you're going to actually participate in this program, just like you do any other appointment for business. And, yeah, it's all strength-to-weight ratio, and it's progressive. We start out, we have a star system, not dissimilar to, you know, when you do dumbbells for your biceps, you start with maybe 20 pounds and progress up heavier and heavier as your strength improves. Well, we use stars, and the first star is the easiest challenge, and the five stars, of course, is the most difficult. But it does give them an opportunity to progress. And the other thing with this is I've been running health clubs for 50 years and training with weights as well during that period of time. And, you know, we all have good and bad days, as you know, from being in the gym yourself. So this program does allow enough choice and enough variety so that if you're not having a good day, you do a little less. Or if you're having a great day, you do a bit more. So.
Yeah, now, but just as a smile, I remember years ago, remember the old Vic Tanney gyms?
I sure do.
you'd walk in for a membership, and they'd say hi. They put you in this little room. Three guys would walk in, 7'6", 380 pounds of muscle, and you didn't dare not sign up.
That's correct. Yeah, that was the way it worked in those days. And, of course, people didn't have the education on fitness or communication like we have today. That wouldn't certainly go over at all now. But they did get away with it for years, and they were quite successful. But it was good that it started getting people thinking about working out, right?
Sure. No, absolutely. No question about it. And more and more today, and you're right, there's, I'm going to call it this obesity epidemic. I have never seen as many overweight people in my entire life. I've been around here for long enough. You walk into the market everywhere you go, or you'll see something in the news where it's showing any given street. The weight is just unbelievable. And some of these kids, it goes overboard, and they understand the problems, the possible problems, the health problems, the cancer, the diabetes, I mean, this list goes on, and yet they still stuff themselves.
Yeah, you know, and that's the reason we didn't put a diet in here, because people resist a diet altogether. What we're doing is trying to educate people on eating healthy to repair their body tissue and build up their immune system. But the bottom line is, and as you're aware of this, I'm sure, Michael, that it's an energy imbalance. The food we're taking in is greater caloric index than the activity we're putting out to burn it up. So we just got to balance that out a little bit. So with our suggestions in the book, we're talking about eating living foods, you know, more raw foods that offer more nutrition, enzymes for your digestion, and actually electrons. People don't realize this, but there's electrons emitted from raw food. It creates energy in your body. And we're also suggesting you go organic, no chemical fertilizers with organic foods and no pesticides. So, and 30% of cancers, if you look at the medical journals, are caused by diet-related issues. So it is a very serious thing, and we're hoping to get people, doing a little activity and watching what they eat or think about what they eat before they eat it, right?
Sure. Now, by the way, I'm breezing through the book, and I'm on page 45 where you've got the stretches. Now, what I like about what you've done here, the woman that is doing the stretches, she's not 5 foot tall and 95 pounds and this, you know, this gorgeous build. She's the average woman. And I think that in and of itself is a great thing to look at, because I've said this for years. I work out, but I'm no Schwarzenegger. And I don't think I could be like him if I took steroids. It's just not going to happen. But I walk into a gym and you got Arnie's picture all over the wall, I've set myself up for failure. But if I walk into a gym and I want to buy a membership and I see guys on the wall that I can get like, now you've got me. I think that's what you've done here in the book.
Yeah, well, first of all, the girl's a kinesiologist, and that's the study of human movement, and she really knows what she's doing. But she's probably could lose a little bit of weight, but she is very fit. But when we did the book, as you notice from the cover, we didn't have any glamorous-looking girls or guys on, half-dressed on the thing. Because the average person is sedentary or sitting at home cannot envision themselves transitioning from what they're doing to that situation. They just don't think that they would fit in at all. So we wanted to make this easy for them to look at. The book's very small, as you know. And where there's a lot more information on fitness that a person can look at, but what one of our comments from Sandra or other kinesiologists is that this is just a start. We just want you to start. The reason that we're using a chair is we don't want you to have to do anything other than sit right where you are now and begin. So we're trying to initiate some activity for them, and this is only a beginning. They can transition from this into other activities. But the idea, the message we're trying to give out, is to keep moving and get moving. And that's a real problem. I know my sister's retired, my brother both, and they're overweight and out of shape. And even though I'm in the industry all my life, I still can't get them going. But I did get them the book, and they are using it, and they are getting a bit of result from it. So,
which is good. But I'm going to go back to Schwarzenegger again. You show me a picture of him, and you say, well, you can be like this in 6 months. No, I can't. So, I'm not in. I'm not going to buy. I'm not going to sign up. But give me something like what you've done here. She's a pretty woman, but where I'm at with it is she's not one of those sex models that they're going to look at and say, well, I can't get like that.
That's correct, yeah. They need to have an image of themselves, of something that they know they can attain. And, I tell people all this fat weight loss gimmicks are really bad for them too, and crash dieting is really really hard on the health, and it's, you always go back to your overweight situation when you're doing that. So if they could actually think of losing a half a pound to a pound a week, you can imagine if you could lose a pound a week, that's 50 pounds in a year. So
that's a
lot of weight. Most people say, you can lose 2 to 5 pounds a week, which is, I'm sure you could if you starved yourself, but it's not a good idea.
No, not at all. And my sister has a few. I hope she's not listening. I'll get it again. But no, she needs to lose a lot of weight. But the point is, and she and I have talked about it. A lot of these diets is you're depriving yourself, and that's really not the way to go. If you walk in and you're enjoying it and you're doing what you're doing, you've got a goal to set and you've got a realistic way to do it. Now, all of a sudden, it becomes something that's achievable, and you don't have to set yourself up for failure, and you don't have to deny yourself.
Right, and I'd say the less is more. You know, start off easy. Like, start at the easiest program we've got here. Like, the programs, the first star for each of our exercises is for a person that's totally deconditioned, cannot, or has some injury, or is elderly, or whatever. I mean, they can just start, and they can start easy, and they do as much as they can. They monitor themselves. We're not doing body mass index here. We're not having people check their weight and their measurements every week, and we're not, it's not restrictive. So we're making it easy, and that's the way, why we call the book Easy Fit. We're making it so easy for them to slip into this this regimen, and we hope that they will, and then they can just slowly but surely progress. And that's the way to do it.
Yeah, and by the way, everybody, go ahead,
sorry.
Well, I was going to say, and everybody's got a chair in their house.
They do. The only thing I make sure they don't have any wheels on it for this, because that could be disastrous. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it needs to be a sturdy chair for them.
What was it? How was it that you, that the three of you created this idea? Because it looks really workable.
Well, because of my sister, mainly she's really deconditioned. I went to her retirement area that she's in Arizona, and all of, there's 1,200 residents there, and they have this beautiful gym. And I went in there with my wife to train. I brought my sister with me, and she had no flexibility, no strength, no oxygen uptake. She just couldn't do anything. So my wife said, well, why don't we take her back home and put her in a chair, and we'll just do our chair workout, because my wife and I stretch in our chairs once in a while at night watching TV. And, you know, being in the fitness industry for years, for 50, over 50 years running fitness centers and gyms, I realized that that's a certain segment of the population. When I first started in industry, there was only 3 to 4% of the population would be considered marketable for a health club. Now it's about 18 to 20%. So there's a huge amount of people that just won't go to the gym and train. So we tried to figure out, and then I collaborated with Sandra and Jennifer, the nutritionist, to figure out what would be the simplest, easiest way to state things. So like even in the nutrition section, we're not saying you must eat this and don't eat that. We're saying here's what you might consider when you go to the grocery store rather than other foods you've been eating now, right? And the problem I've got also with this, being a fitness advocate, is that the children of our nation are just as bad as the adults. You know, they don't play outside anymore. They don't do recreational sports. It's all on their iPhones or computers. And I'm afraid as we move on a couple hundred years from now, everyone will have big heads and big eyeballs and no limbs. You know, it's going to be kind of we really got a problem here. We need to get people exercising. So.
Yeah, by the way, I'm looking at the picture of you guys in the newspaper where you're standing there and she's sitting. You know, I would have a problem working with her. She looks like she's, there's a lot of mischief in that face.
Hell yeah. she works in rehabilitation as a kinesiologist. That's about human movement, right? And there's biomechanics, there's orthopedics, and there's rehabilitation or the disciplines in that area. And she works on rehabilitation. No, she's a very sweet kid. She's
absolutely
from the University of Calgary.
She looks
great to work with.
Now, let me ask you this. The program in and of itself, you got the book, but does it go farther than that? What about maintenance? You get it down, you work it out. What do you do with maintenance?
Well, we're telling people to move on and find other activities to do to maintain themselves as well as maintain their little program. The reason for the stars and picking different things is that everyone has a favorite exercise. You know how guys used to want to bench press every time they went in the gym? That's what they did for their chest. They had to bench press as much as they could. So everyone has a tendency that way. And so with the stars we have here, there'll be exercises they really enjoy doing, they feel comfortable doing, and so they can continue doing that. But we're asking them to move on and find other activities. You know, they could start jogging or maybe swimming or going to a gym eventually or whatever. So.
Yeah, you know, the old way, and I was part of this, the old way was you went into the gym, you had a routine. One day was, you know, chest and the triceps. The next was back and biceps.
Split routines,
It's changed. We look at it completely different today because there comes that point without mixing and matching things, you level off, you're not going to get any bigger.
That's right. You know, that was all about super compensation. It's kind of a technical term, but it's about training. You can overtrain and train to a certain point, and you can super compensate and get a little stronger as you go along. And we are all focused on bodybuilding. Now I think people are more just generally wanting to look more athletic and feel and you know, live a better life. Our program, if they do it completely, is a complete workout because we do warm up, we do cardiovascular strength training and stretching. So, but it's all a mental thing. People have to make this a priority like they do making money and their family and stuff like that. It has to become part of their life. And it's not easy, so that's why we want them to start slow and enjoy themselves as they go along.
Oh, no question, because when you really come down to it, it's a mindset. Everything, no matter what it is, it's a mindset. It's something that you do or you don't do. I've worked out for so many years, I don't know what it's like not to work out. If you were sitting here in the studio with us, there's the desk, the office, the studio. If you look off to the left, there's an entire gym there. So it's just...
Good for you. Congratulations. That's great.
Yeah, it's a way of life. I got it. Okay, we're starting to run out of time. David, is there a website we can find you at?
Not a website. I do have an email. They could email me if they needed to. It's workout@telus.net. And the book can be obtained at Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble at BNN.com. And I think AuthorHouse.com also. So.
Great. And it's easy fit. And by the way, if somebody missed it, it's going to be up on our website, so it'll be easy to find. Hey, David Wakefield, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, Michael, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'm so pleased to know that you do exercise. So that's great.
I gotta go hit the bench. I'll talk to you later. Take
care,
David.
All right, talk to you later. Thanks. Bye.
Good night.
Off comes the clown's disguise. The curtain's fallen. The music softly dies. But I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is a wrap.
They've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again. And these.